I next met with Dr. John Crown, and to begin, he discussed management of metastatic HER2-positive disease and commented on the landmark CLEOPATRA trial evaluating the combination of a taxane, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab, and how this factors into how he evaluates patients with ER-positive, HER2-positive metastatic disease.
Neil, I would have to say that the CLEOPATRA data are very, very compelling, and we'll come back to them in a moment, but on the more general issue of chemo plus trastuzumab versus single agent trastuzumab versus hormones plus trastuzumab versus hormones alone for an ER-positive, HER2-positive patient, I must tell you my default position is to give chemotherapy and anti-HER2 therapy to a patient who is HER2-positive metastatic. There will be departures from that default, principally on the grounds of performance status. I never like to be ageist about these things, but if you do have an elderly, frail patient who's got a poor performance status, whose disease is ER positive and HER2 positive, it certainly is reasonable to think of giving them endocrine treatment plus anti-HER2 therapy. And we have several bodies of data, including the 30,008 trial and other studies, which have shown that the addition of anti-HER2 therapy to aromatase inhibitors is superior in that niche group of patients. However, I must admit that I am terminally biased by the experience of seeing patients with very prolonged, complete, and durable remissions. And my instinct is to give, with exceptions, chemotherapy plus anti-HER2 therapy. At the moment, the CLEOPATRA data are really very clear. It's as clear a difference as we have seen, favoring the use of pertuzumab together with trastuzumab and docetaxel versus the docetaxel and trastuzumab alone. I was very surprised to see such a powerful impact, but it is there, and the data, I believe, are absolutely authentic.
I must be really naive, because I was surprised there was any impact when I first thought about it, and I was also really surprised. Let me ask one thing, though. In the triple-positive patient, when do you integrate hormonal therapy, like after the chemo when they're in the maintenance anti-HER therapy?
I would say that the most standard answer, Neil, is that patients in whom the decision is made to give chemotherapy as a component of their treatment will get chemotrastuzumab to the point where they no longer wish to take chemo or have had cumulative taxane toxicity. And provided they are still in remission, what we will often do at that stage is to stop the chemo, continue the anti-HER2 therapy, whichever format it is taken, and add endocrine agents at that stage. However, I have to tell you, there's a little part of me always wonders if we shouldn't just give the anti-HER2 therapy and the anti-hormone therapy together with the chemo. We have had a long prejudice against giving hormones and chemo at the same time. That prejudice came from a different era with different kinds of endocrine agents and with a different understanding of the biology of cancer. And we've looked at it in the lab, and I must say it's not obvious to us that there is a deterioration from adding anti-estrogen therapy right from the beginning. So we don't know the answer to that yet. There were data presented, I guess, a year and a half ago, which did suggest it was a valid approach. And I think clinicians need to look at those data and come to their own conclusions.
You said chemo and trastuzumab, but now that you have pertuzumab available, did you mean to say chemo, trastuzumab, pertuzumab?
I think most patients will now, in the current state of the data following the CLEOPATRA study, and depending on the availability, I think most patients will now be given chemotherapy plus the two antibodies. The data are clear and they're positive. I would be keen over the years to see that the long-term implications of these data. As you know, Neil, I have an interest in the notion of trying to cure HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. If we are getting a higher rate of complete remission, will we get, and this is speculative, we don't know this yet from CLEOPATRA, but is it possible we may get a higher rate of durable complete remission, and is it possible we might get a higher rate of cure? These would be really interesting questions to see as that data matures.
Let's talk a little bit about T-DM1, and maybe you can review what we know about it, where you think it fits in terms of treatment of metastatic breast cancer, any new data. We saw the Teresa data last year, but maybe just kind of provide a little bit of an overview of where we are with T-DM1.
Well, the first thing to say about T-DM1 is it is just such mesmerically exciting science and technology. I mean, talk about the magic bullet, talk about the dream of oncologists of having a highly specific delivery system which would bring anti-cancer drugs to the cancer cell and avoid most of the normal tissue toxicity. T-DM1 is as perfect as we have seen. I think it's really interesting. I've worked in Memorial Sloan Kettering for many years, and there was a fine group of people there who were working in tumor immunology. And the great holy grail was always to look for tumor-specific antigens that would allow a degree of differentiation between cancer and normal. And it's quite striking to me that the antibody treatment which has made the biggest difference in breast cancer are those which are targeted against what is a normal receptor, a normal antigen, which is quantitatively abnormal rather than being a separate tumor-specific antigen. And it's allowed this amazing delivery of a variety of different therapeutic options to this particular group of patients. T-DM1 in the original trials, the small randomized phase 2 presented by Edith Perez originally, which showed that it was at least equivalent and far less toxic than free trastuzumab plus docetaxel, it was simply, I think, an extraordinary observation. The subsequent report that it was superior to conventional second-line therapy consisting of capecitabine and lapatinib in trastuzumab pretreated patients, and again, was less toxic. It's as if we were wrong. Maybe there is a free lunch, Neil. Maybe there is something which works well and doesn't bring increased toxicity in its path. So we're waiting for the definitive large-scale phase 3 randomized data, first-line metastatic, which will be presented. And of course, we will also have very interesting trials in the post-neoadjuvant setting and also in the adjuvant setting. So I think it'll be a very exciting time for this drug in the next few years.
You know, I think one of the most interesting trials involving T-DM1 is the Catherine trial from the NSABP, the post-neoadjuvant study. Can you talk about that?
I think that's very interesting. And I think it's actually more interesting now than we thought it would be at the time for a very simple reason. Something else has happened, Neil, over the last several years since the first generation HER2-positive adjuvant trastuzumab trials came out. The results are just better. We saw data from the BETH trial, which was originally BCIRG trio study with NSABP and others, which was studying the addition of bevacizumab to conventional chemotherapy plus trastuzumab in HER2-positive disease. Now, sadly, the study was not positive, showing a benefit from the addition of bevacizumab, which is something we would have hoped on the basis of preclinical data. But there was something very heartening from the trial. The overall relapse-free survival of patients on that study was very good and was better than the identical chemotherapy had produced in the earlier TCH arm of BCIRG006. In fact, for patients who were node negative going into the trial, it was about 92 or 93%, and for the overall group, it was about 89 to 90%, suggesting that we're doing very, very well in the adjuvant setting. But of course, Neil, giving us this extraordinary challenge for all of the new drugs in the adjuvant setting and the HER2-positive space, because we may have underestimated how well the control arms would perform and how well we were doing. The nice and interesting thing about the post-neoadjuvant study is that it is selecting a group of patients who've had induction therapy with chemotherapy and trastuzumab, but who have had residual disease. It is, I think, an index of how far we have come in HER2-positive disease that we are now truly, I guess, disappointed when we give somebody neoadjuvant induction therapy and we find any residual cancer, because we're seeing such high rates of pathological complete response across a variety of different regimens used with anti-HER2 therapies. So the study will enrich for patients who have demonstrated some degree of chemotrastuzumab resistance. These will be patients who have had some residual disease, and they are randomized to get T-DM1 or to continue on trastuzumab. And I think that will be a very interesting body of data.
Let's talk a little bit about sequencing as it relates to T-DM1 in your own view. In the recent ASCO guidelines, they came out very strongly in terms of first-line Cleopatra, taxane, pertuzumab, trastuzumab. And also, and we've seen this from investigators in every survey we've done the last year or two, T-DM1, second line, period. Agree or disagree?
Them's the data. I mean, it does look like that at the moment. The other, I think, more generic story that needs to be told here, Neil, is that I think the circumstantial evidence and indeed the trials-based evidence for continuing anti-HER2 therapy beyond first and beyond second line treatment, I think is getting stronger. And this is something that's important because depending on where your listeners are, in some parts of the world, there is only approval for one line of anti-HER2 therapy. Clearly, the data at the moment, the cleanest data for first-line therapy suggest that for patients in whom the chemotherapy backbone is appropriate, the right anti-HER2 therapy is the combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab. what was the most widely licensed, regulatorily approved second-line treatment was the combination of capecitabine plus lapatinib has been cleanly compared to T-DM1. T-DM1 is better and safer. So I think the notion that first-line therapy should be chemo, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, second-line treatment should be T-DM1, I must say it makes great sense. There will be exceptions, but it makes great sense that that should be the default position.
Where does lapatinib, and particularly the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab, a non-chemo regimen, fit into your sequence? A lot of people like to give patients a break. Older patients, they don't want to give chemo to. What's your experience with this combination?
It's good. I must say, I've done several studies myself and with my colleagues looking at anti-HER2 TKI, specifically lapatinib, together with trastuzumab. There's a real sad story with lapatinib. I just think it was an awful shame that early on there wasn't a good, clean first-line study done of chemotherapy plus trastuzumab plus lapatinib versus chemotherapy plus trastuzumab, because the body of circumstantial evidence which suggests that there is synergy between these two drugs, which is clinically relevant, is high, including, of course, the study which was presented and published a few years ago by Drs. Blackwell, Burstyn, and others, in which they took patients whose disease had been resistant to trastuzumab and randomly assigned them to get lapatinib alone or lapatinib plus trastuzumab, and found that continuing trastuzumab, the drug which had failed, provided a benefit when given with lapatinib. Now, this to me can only mean one thing, which is that in addition to the individual activities of the drugs, there is something special about using them together, something which we would call synergy. And for that reason, we have started a large-scale randomized trial in Europe in which we're comparing chemo-trastuzumab to chemo-trastuzumab-lapatinib. To be honest, Richard, the increasing availability of pertuzumab is going to complicate the completion of that trial, but there are still many jurisdictions where pertuzumab is not available. And we are hopefully going to get some answers on that as well. We've also got the data, very interesting body of data from NeoAlto and Alto, which again, I think make a strong case that there is an interaction in terms of an anti-tumor efficacy when you add lapatinib to trastuzumab, but which has not unfortunately translated into meaningful survival benefits. Now, there may be other reasons for that, but for sure, the next generation of studies, I think, will be interesting. There are other TKIs out there, neratinib and afatinib. I think it would make sense to try and look at some of these drugs as well. Perhaps we will get the chance to do trastuzumab plus pertuzumab plus a TKI versus two of those drugs alone, because they do have potentially different mechanisms of resistance.
So when or if you use lapatinib in the management of metastatic disease, which I assume you do at some point, for example, a patient that gets Cleopatra first line, TDM second line, and then at some later point you're thinking about lapatinib, are you generally using it with capecitabine or trastuzumab?
Well, it must be stated at the outset, Neil, that in most countries, the regulatory approval for lapatinib resides on its use with capecitabine, very specifically. That is what is usually indicated in terms of, you know, legal regulatory approval. There will be some patients who may have had capecitabine before and whom capecitabine is not suitable. I have treated individual patients with a combination of the two anti-HER2 therapies without chemotherapy. And I've certainly seen patients respond, and I've certainly seen patients who appear to have had a more prolonged degree of disease control. The other little wrinkle in the story, of course, is the patients who get brain metastases, because lapatinib does cross into the blood-brain barrier, trastuzumab does not. So if you have somebody who's had a degree of systemic control and who gets isolated brain metastasis, a patient who may often benefit quite a bit from focused radiotherapy, stereotactic or whole brain radiotherapy, depending on the anatomy and the distribution of their disease, it's very, very appealing to add lapatinib into their treatment afterwards to see if you can reduce the occurrence of further brain metastases that are outside of the reach of trastuzumab.
So you mentioned brain mets, and that same JCO issue with the ASCO guidelines, the general guidelines of metastatic HER2-positive disease. There's another guidelines paper of HER2-positive CNS disease. And the one thing I want to ask you about from that paper, because again, I've heard a lot of oncologists ask me about this, cases, et cetera, is the patient, and I'm not even sure how often this happens, but definitely patients like this, who has a great systemic response to, let's say, a Cleopatra-type approach in the first-line setting, is in complete remission everywhere systemically and breaks through with one or more brain mets. And the question there is, okay, you're going to deal with the brain locally, but do you switch anti-HER therapy? And I was interested that this panel came up with the fact that you ought to just keep the same anti-HER therapy going. What did you think about that?
I tend to agree with them. I must say, in general, because of a long experience with anti-HER2 therapy at this stage, we've seen many patients who have come back with isolated CNS recurrence who've had really good peripheral responses. Treat the brain metastasis on its own merits, either surgery, stereotactic, whole brain, depending on the anatomy. And I must say, in general, I've tended to continue the trastuzumab, and if further problems arise, then to add lapatinib in.
I want to move over from HER2-positive to HER2-negative metastatic disease, but one more question about HER2-positive. It's kind of a bridge to the HER2-negative. It involves mTOR inhibitors in HER2-positive disease, and specifically everolimus. We saw data from the BOLERO-3 trial looking at that strategy, and I'm curious right now what your thoughts are about, and we'll talk, I wanted to ask what your thoughts are in general about ER-positive metastatic disease and the role of mTOR inhibitors, but what about specifically in HER2-positive disease, and is it different whether they're ER-positive or ER-negative metastatic?
I don't think we have data to routinely support the use of mTOR inhibitors with anti-HER2 therapies at this point in time, which is a shame because in terms of the pathways, it looks like it would make a lot of sense, but we don't have data to support that yet.
Let's talk about ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease. And a common situation is a patient who's on adjuvant endocrine therapy, for example, an aromatase inhibitor, and develops metastatic disease. How do you think through that clinical scenario in terms of sort of what to do next? And what are some of the key factors you consider?
Well, Neil, I must say the longer I'm treating metastatic breast cancer, the more I want to try and keep people on an endocrine backbone treatment approach for as long as possible. And we will try and play around with endocrine therapies. And thankfully, we now have newer molecular agents, which, you know, enable us to delay the time from which a patient becomes a chemotherapy patient. The big thing that always sways in my mind, of course, is the likelihood of a response to endocrine therapy. So if you have somebody who's de novo or who has relapsed remotely from adjuvant endocrine treatment, somebody in whom you think there's a high likelihood of an endocrine response, we will always reach for endocrine therapy first. Somebody who relapses while taking endocrine therapy, but in whom you would like to avoid chemotherapy, that may be somebody where you would look for a modified endocrine treatment. The other thing that has to really be borne in mind, and this is critically important, for metastatic patients, if you are on endocrine therapy alone, an aromatase inhibitor or an aromatase inhibitor plus fulvestrant, your quality of life in terms of what the oncologist does to you is pretty good. It really is. You have minimal side effects. When you start adding other agents in with it, you do have a higher prospect of benefit, but you are running into some issues in terms of quality of life related side effects. So I think there still is a big area for a clinical judgment and the art of breast oncology for individual patients here.
Let me ask, is everolimus approved for metastatic breast cancer?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, we use everolimus, and I've had some fantastic control with everolimus. Patients who have had 6, 8, 10 more months of disease control, clear-cut shrinkage, improvement in quality of life in patients that had symptomatic pulmonary and other metastases. It can be a really, really useful treatment. Patients do tend to know they're on it compared to just being on an aromatase inhibitor. It would be relatively common to have a degree of low-level toxicity. Fatigue would be common. A little bit of stomatitis would be relatively common. And sometimes you can be a victim of success. And the patients that are having quite prolonged periods of disease control then may come back with pulmonary infiltrates and things like that. But in general, it's been a really useful addition. And it's so nice to be able to look at somebody and say, you know, you don't need chemotherapy yet. We've got something else we can try first before we need to cross that chemotherapy Rubicon.
Now, you mentioned everolimus and an aromatase inhibitor. Of course, the primary data from the BOLERO was exemestane. Do you use it just with exemestane? Do you use it with other AIs? Do you use it with other hormonal therapies?
I think at this point in time, it's the data are safest for using it with an AI. I'm not particularly hung up on which AI it's used with. I think that will often be a function, Neil, of what the patient has had exposure to in the adjuvant setting. And there can just be issues of habit on the part of oncologists in that regard. The other drug that I've been quite involved with in recent years is still an investigational drug, but the CDK4/6 inhibitor, palbociclib, the data, many of your listeners will know, from a randomized phase 2 trial are highly provocative and have led to a large-scale randomized phase 3 trial, which hopefully will give us data.
Now, again, this is with an AI, is that right?
That is correct.
Have you had patients receive this on trial yourself?
Oh, yes. We were one of the leading recruiters on the randomized phase 2 trial.
Is that right? So you put, yeah, because you were involved with Trio and all, right?
I'm actually the second author on all that stuff.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The story basically was the trial was done. Well, if you go back a stage further, Dr. Finn and Dr. Slayman were studying their very extensive, comprehensive library of breast cancer cell lines and were wondering, would the CDK4/6 inhibitors, which have their profound activity in the cell cycle, would they be useful in kinetically very active HER2-positive disease? And they actually got compelling data which suggested that it might also have a role in hormone receptor-positive disease. So a randomized phase 2 trial was started in which patients were randomly assigned to get AI with or without the CDK4/6 inhibitor. And on the basis of otherwise molecularly unselected receptor positivity, the data looked really quite staggering, with what looked like perhaps a doubling of progression-free survival, increased response, etc. We then went back and did a further cohort of patients who were hopefully enriched for what looked like a promising biomarker panel. Now, as it happened, the biomarker panel did not enrich. We saw the same benefit across the two groups, but it gave us a larger group of patients, and we have seen a yawning chasm in the progression-free survival curves between the two arms of the trial, which urgently needed phase 3 confirmation, which trial is pretty much largely completed now. And that drug will be studied in a number of different settings. It's also being studied with fulvestrant. It'll be studied in the neoadjuvant setting. And we're all very hopeful that we will be able, if we get confirmation of its benefit in the phase 3 metastatic trial, that we could look at it in an adjuvant trial. Nice thing about this drug, Neil, is it's not that toxic. It's quite a mild drug. We're not going to see too much difficulty with it.
So getting back to everolimus, you said that you think about it in patients who are relapsing on hormonal therapy. Does that mean in general that's what you do? Or do you sort of look at how long it took them to relapse or how sick they are? How do you make that decision about whether you use everolimus or, for example, fulvestrant?
Again, it's very individual. And I mean, a lot of it depends on burden of disease, imminence of problems related to disease, etc. One's, I think, you know, enthusiasm for using it early on will be higher if you perceive a greater need for activity. If you think that you have somebody who's essentially asymptomatic with a very low level of metastatic disease, which is hormone receptor positive, in which you have the luxury of seeing, can they get a good quality period of time without any additional toxicity? It might be reasonable in them to try an AI first.
One other question about everolimus. I have heard some investigators, and Hope Rugo and Joyce O'Shaughnessy are two that pop into mind, who are super enthusiastic about preemptive mouthwashes with corticosteroids to prevent the mucositis. Do you ever do that?
We have not, but I certainly know many of my colleagues have and have been very enthusiastic about it. And I've heard from other investigators who have used it that it has been very, very useful.
You also mentioned, now that there are more patients on it and more follow-ups, starting to see pulmonary infiltrates. What do you usually do? Is it you just screen people clinically for dyspnea? Do you do any imaging? And how do you manage if they do develop some kind of pulmonary problem?
We would be screening these patients radiologically because they all have metastatic disease. Our standard of practice would be for a patient on treatment for metastatic disease would be fairly comprehensive imaging on an approximately 3-monthly basis. So we've seen the infiltrate problem arise in two different circumstances. One is where it arises asymptomatically as an infiltrate. And the second one is where people do complain of cough and dyspnea. We do tend to investigate it. And just to say parenthetically, we have seen several patients who've been on everolimus who've got pneumocystis pneumonia. We have had well microbiologically documented pneumocystis pneumonia in two patients recently that have had it. Just to perhaps caution colleagues who are listening in that if you do see somebody who is unwell with pulmonary infiltrates, they do need to be taken on their own merits and investigated on their own merits. And assumptions should not be made that it is necessarily specifically drug toxicity and is not some other infectious complication.
So a couple other issues related to HER2-negative metastatic disease. We've talked about hormones, but these patients generally also end up receiving chemotherapy. And then, of course, you have triple negative patients who that's what they do receive. Can you talk a little bit about the common agents that you utilize when you're going beyond anthracyclines and taxanes, usually in the adjuvant setting, in terms of HER2-negative disease and sort of how you go about selecting them? There's been a lot of discussion about capecitabine versus eribulin. What's your take on all that?
I believe that there are a core group of chemotherapy cytotoxic drugs that patients with metastatic breast cancer, during the course, the trajectory of their illness, which sadly will be fatal in the overwhelming majority of cases, that patients, our default position should be that patients get access to all of them at some time during their illness. And the big ones are taxanes, anthracyclines, capecitabine, gemcitabine, vinorelbine, and I would now add onto that list eribulin. And I must say, I have been hugely impressed with eribulin. There are historical quirks to the way cancer drugs have been developed in breast cancer compared to other cancers. Because we have so many active drugs in breast cancer, new drugs do tend to get added in at the end. And I think it was a very brave decision to do the Embrace Eribulin trials, which were done in patients that were incredibly, in truth, unprecedentedly heavily pretreated, showing as it did a p-value for an overall survival advantage. And as a result, I have now enthusiastically added eribulin onto that list of agents that I do believe it is one of that armory that metastatic patients do need to get a try with. From a strict regulatory point of view, the drug tends to be given in far advanced, multiply pretreated disease, but it's quite provocative to speculate as to what its activity might be in earlier stage disease, given its activity in later stages. I've tended to move it up a little bit. I tend to give it now after taxanes, anthracyclines, and capecitabine. I tend to add eribulin in at that stage.
Any toxicities that you've seen that you know you kind of look out for when you use eribulin?
I would say the one toxicity that people have is, of course, linked in with what they've had before, is a bit of neuropathy. And you do need to be a little bit careful about peripheral neuropathy in patients that get that drug. In general, on a day one and day eight schedule, which is the schedule we would tend to often give patients who are heavily pretreated, I would have to describe it as a well-tolerated drug that keeps people out of hospital, doesn't give them severe side effects. And generally, people that have been on it and have been on other drugs tend to think of it as being not that bad an experience.
So I know you were part of an interesting paper presented last year's ASCO about Oncotype, and there's a lot of discussion about genomic analyses in the adjuvant setting. In the U.S., Oncotype certainly, 21 gene recurrence scores certainly, is what's mainly used in Europe. I'm not so sure about Europe. Seems like Ki-67 and other things maybe are looked at, maybe MammaPrint. So first of all, I'm curious what your overall take is on the clinical science of what we know about this, and also your perception on what's going on the other side of the ocean.
Well, Neil, I'm old enough to remember when the first papers came out which suggested that there was a small but apparently reproducible benefit from the addition of conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy in the treatment of patients with node-negative breast cancer. And this was very exciting. But of course, when we would show these data to other colleagues in surgery or in other disciplines, they would say, would you look at that tiny separation in the curves and look at how much treatment you're giving to people who are probably cured already? Now, there's no doubt that when you look back at the data alone and in meta-analysis, there was a benefit. And before we had any further molecular segregation, we could put our hands up and say, you know what, we do add some extra percents to your chance, madam, of being alive and well in 5 years and probably in 10 years if you do submit yourself to the discomfort of chemotherapy for 3 to 4 months or 6 months, depending on the regimen. But yes, madam, you are right. There's a high chance you're cured anyway as a result of what the surgeon has done to you. And there's a reasonably high chance we're giving you toxicity that you don't need. So I had that conversation so often, up until fairly recently in my career, and the Oncotype has, to me, been one of the biggest breakthroughs, the most practice-changing technologies that we've had. Because it's great that it's yet something else which prognosticates. There are lots of things which prognosticate. But the really great thing about the Oncotype is when you had that patient who you wondered, am I actually depriving them of something? I wonder, is there a small chemotherapy benefit? Should I give them the chemotherapy? But when you see that low Oncotype score coming back at you, it is just so reassuring that you can look them in the eye and say, you know, madam, with a very high degree of certainty, you don't need chemotherapy. That makes them so happy.
What actually is going on, though, I don't know if you can generalize in general in terms of what's going on over in Europe, et cetera, in terms of what's being done and is it different in different countries?
Well, in Ireland, we're in a more advanced situation in the sense that we have a little interesting cultural thing in Ireland. We have a small number of medical oncologists, but they're overwhelmingly trained in North America and in the United States. We have a large cooperative group, the Irish Cooperative Oncology Research Group, which is affiliated both to NSABP and to ECOG, and indeed to TRIO and BIG and other groups. So we got early access through the TAILOR-X trial to the Oncotype test, and there was an extremely high acceptance of this trial in Ireland. We put over 700 patients in Ireland on that study. In fact, there was 1 year, Neil, where we estimate that something like 35% of all patients with primary breast cancer in Ireland went on the trial. We enthusiastically embraced it, and we were delighted that so many Irish patients avoided chemotherapy as a result of the trial, and we're eagerly awaiting the results of the randomization that's based around the intermediate risk group. In other jurisdictions in Europe, there is perhaps a slower degree of acceptance. In Ireland, I should state that following our involvement in the trial, it was routinely picked up by both our public and by our private health insurers in Ireland. So Irish women do all have access to the Oncotype, provided they meet the criteria of having node negative, ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancer. It is our standard of care, and somebody would have to have a reason not to offer it to a patient now at this stage. We also believe, by the way, that it saves money. If your standard of practice is to give docetaxel cyclophosphamide regimen, which is a regimen which would be widely used for these ER positive, node negative patients, it is likely at least cost neutral. And if the TAILOR-X trial were to show that we could avoid chemotherapy for the intermediate risk group patients, it will save money. In other countries in Europe and other jurisdictions, it has had a more patchy uptake. There are other indigenous European prognosticators that are in use, such as MammaPrint. There's also the German prognostic model. I don't think any of them have the same verifiable prediction capacity that Oncotype has. I think that's what really sets it apart at this point in time. And the real big question, of course, is will it also be generalizable to node positive patients? And I strongly suspect when we see data from the ongoing studies, we may well find that there are patients with node positive disease who can avoid chemotherapy as well. But that is, I think, still speculative.
So does that mean you never use it in patients with node positive disease, or are there situations where you have used it? I mean, I'm sure you can use it.
We use it as part of the SWOG study in patients who sign a consent form to join the trial. It is not either reimbursed or approved for use in node-positive disease at this point in time. I will be more reassured when we see more truly prospective data on that question.
I saw a survey that was done of ESMO members. I don't have the paper in front of me. I know Martine Picard was one of the authors. They just sent out a survey of how people manage early breast cancer to, quote, ESMO members. I'm not exactly sure who filled it out, but a lot of people were ESMO members and everybody was European. And if I read it correctly, it didn't seem like ESMO-wide Oncotype was used that much, and it looked like Ki-67 was used a lot. First of all, is that the case? And what would you say to somebody who says, well, you know, I can use Ki-67 and ER and HER2, and I don't need to do Oncotype?
In answer to the first part of your question, I think it is absolutely correct. I think there are several very large jurisdictions in Europe where the Oncotype is not used. It would not be anything like the standard of care in Western Europe than it is in North America. There's a lot of variability with Ki-67 reading, assays, etc. I've just been very impressed by the relentless reproducibility of the data on the Oncotype. I think the validation that it went through on large-scale trials, to me, it is a standard of care that has not yet been met by any other test in terms of prediction.
One final thing about Oncotype I'm curious about. People seem to often focus on the issue that you mentioned, the cost effectiveness, that when it gets utilized, you know, a lot less chemotherapy is given. But there are also situations theoretically where a patient's destined not to get chemotherapy and they come back with a surprising high score and they do get chemotherapy. And there, I guess you're looking at savings on the cost of treating recurrence, not to mention the human aspect of it. As you utilize this tool, you end up using less chemo than you would have used, and how often do you end up using chemo when you never would have used it?
Well, when we actually did a little exercise of looking at the patients that we had put on Oncotype and had made treatment decisions on Oncotype and just did a kind of a guesstimate of what we would have recommended in the absence of Oncotype, we found that at least one half of the time a treatment decision was changed on the basis of Oncotype. And it was the majority change was to save chemotherapy in people who we would have, I believe, retrospectively in error, recommended unnecessary chemotherapy to. But yes, there is a minority of patients who will have an unsuspected higher risk of recurrence and an unsuspected higher potential benefit from chemotherapy who I believe, thankfully, are spared being misidentified as not requiring a treatment which could perhaps prolong their life.